This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Even though new journalism is old now, Tom Wolfe is still celebrated for pioneering the style. New journalism used the techniques of fiction, descriptive scene settings, dramatic tension, and dialogue. In that new and flamboyant style, Wolfe wrote about Ken Kesey's LSD experiments in the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. His essay, Radical Chic, mocked white liberals eating fancy hors d'oeuvres at a fundraising party for the Black Panthers. Wolfe probed the space program in The Right Stuff and the excesses of the 1980s in Bonfire of the Vanities, his first novel. Terry interviewed him in 1987 when Bonfire of the Vanities was published. She started by asking him about new journalism.
You started to use the techniques of fiction to write journalistic stories. What were you reacting against in the style of journalism?
There was a neutral, so-called objective voice that journalists were expected to assume at that time. And now we're getting back to the late 50s and the early 60s. And I frankly found it absolutely boring. I also, having had it in the back of my mind that I was, you know, at some point I was going to quit journalism and write fiction. I mean, that's what everyone interested in writing starts into journalism with. That's the idea. I began to be intrigued with the notion of, well, here I am a journalist. Well, why not use, if it's possible, some of these techniques that short story writers and novelists use while doing nonfiction? And this became a great game and a great experiment. And pretty soon, by the mid-60s, seemed to me much more important than writing fiction. I mean, there was nothing going on in fiction that even remotely compared in excitement with what was going on in what at that time was called the new journalism.
Was it a sudden thing that got you to write that way? Did you suddenly say, well, I can't write this piece in the old style, I've got to write it in this new style, the old style just won't work? Or did your writing gradually evolve?
No, well, I did have a kind of a involuntary epiphanal moment in, let's see, what year was it? It was 1963, it must have been. There was a, late in 62, a newspaper strike began. I was by now working for the New York Herald Tribune, and I suddenly found myself out of a job, and I needed to make some money, so I went over to Esquire magazine and sold them on the idea of a story on customized cars, which at that time were being made in very fanciful forms by teenagers in Los Angeles, the era of Big Daddy Ed Roth and George Barris and so on. So they said, okay, going out to California and do this story. I remember checking into the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and over the course of 4 weeks running up this enormous bill, I came back to New York, found myself utterly blocked. I could not write this story. I went to the managing editor of Esquire, Byron Dobell, who's now editor of American Heritage, and I told him, I said, Byron, I'm sorry, I just simply cannot write this story. I just have to drop the assignment. He says, you can't do that. We've got about $10,000 worth of color plates of these ridiculous automobiles you're supposed to be writing about on the already made. We can't do anything about that. So why don't you just give us your notes, and we'll get some competent writer to put them together. So with a very heavy heart one night, as a matter of fact, it must have been after 9 o'clock at one night, I started typing up these notes in the form of a memo which began, Dear Byron, the first place I saw customized cars was at 18 Fair in North Hollywood, California, as straight as I could do it, but as fast as I could do it to get this humiliating task over with. And I ended up typing at top speed for about 8 or 9 hours. And in that time, I produced 50 typewritten pages. I took this over to Esquire, turned it in about 9 o'clock in the morning, went home to sleep, and I got a call about 4 that afternoon from Byron Dobell saying, well, Tom, we're going to knock the Dear Byron off the top of your memo and run the memo as the article. And that article became the one entitled The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby, which was the title of my first book. What had happened was, in writing what I thought was a memorandum to a single individual who was about my own age, Byron DeBell, that I had somehow liberated myself from all of the fears and all of the constraints that you feel when you are going to write something as formal as a magazine article for a national audience. I had reached that kind of tone that a lot of people are able to reach in writing a letter to a friend. There are many great writers of letters who freeze when they are told to write a course paper.
Well, a lot of people tell you, write it as if you're telling your friend about it. Of course, easier said than done.
Well,
it implies that you're more articulate somehow when you're talking to a friend about it, which isn't, of course, necessarily
true. Not necessarily true, but you are freer, and it'll work the first time for anybody.
Well, that article established a new style for you, which you've been building on for a long time. Now, that style has created real reverberations within journalism. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the legacy of that style. It seems that it spawned a lot of terrific writing, and it spawned a lot of bad writing, too. I don't know if you feel that way. Do you? that there are a lot of excesses that have been...
It can lead to excesses, particularly in the form of purple prose.
Yeah.
It's a very demanding form, and I think a lot of people who try don't realize how much reporting you have to do first. Without the information behind it, all of these techniques, which are things like scene-by-scene construction and use of extended passages of dialogue and point of view in the Henry James sense, without the facts, which can only be obtained through reporting, it can really fall flat. It just becomes a verbose technique.
Can I ask you the dread questions about your white suits?
Yeah, now we're getting serious. Yes, go ahead.
Let's get down to real business here. I mean, your signature as far as your wardrobe goes has always been the three-piece suit, tailor-made, usually white. Now, something I've always wondered about wearing a white suit is that you really have to protect yourself because anything is going to get you dirty. And as a journalist, it seems to me you really want to dive into a situation and do what needs to be done. But if you're wearing all white, you have to keep everything at a certain distance.
Well, two things that come to mind when you ask about that. One is, I have discovered that for me, you know, maybe it doesn't work for everybody, for me, it is much more effective to arrive in any situation as a man from Mars than to try to fit in. I've tried, when I first started out in journalism, in magazine work particularly, I used to try to fit in. I remember doing a thing on stock car racing. I went down to North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, to do a story on a stock car racer named Junior Johnson. And I tried to fit into the stock car scene. I wore a green tweed suit and a blue button-down shirt and a black knit tie and some brown suede shoes and a brown Borsellino hat. I figured that was really casual, really the stock car races. And after about 5 days, Junior Johnson, whom I was writing about, came to me and says, "I don't mean to be rude or anything," he says, "but people I've known all my life down here in Ingle Hollow," that was where he came from, "say, they keep asking me, Junior, who's that little green man following you around?" It was then it had dawned on me that, A, nobody for 50 miles in any direction was wearing a suit of any color, or a tie for that matter, or a hat. And the less said about brown suede shoes, the better, I can assure you. And so I wasn't fitting in to start with. I was also depriving myself of the ability to ask some very obvious questions if I thought I fit in. I was dying to know what an overhead cam was. People were always talking about overhead cams, but if you're pretending to fit in, you can't ask these obvious questions. After that, I gave it up. I would turn up always in a suit, and many times a white suit, and just be the village information gatherer. And you'll be amazed if you're willing to strike that role.
When you were doing the research for your book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is about Ken Kesey and the psychedelic acid trips, were you dressed like that too?
Oh, yes. And it would have been, actually, to have tried to fit into that scene would have been fatal, perhaps literally fatal. Kesey had this this abiding distaste for pseudo-hippies or hipsters. There was really no such term at that time, but well, let's call them pseudo-hipsters. You know, the journalist or lawyer or teacher who on the weekends puts on his jeans and smokes a little dope and plays some Coltrane records and tries to be part of the scene. And so he had a device called Testing People's Cool. And I remember once witnessing this. It was on one of these weekends. And he said, all right, let's everybody get naked. That was his word for naked. And get on our bikes and go up Route 1. This was in California. And they did. They took off all their clothes. They got on their motorcycles and they started riding up Route 1. Now, this separated the hippies from the weekend hipsters, if you will, very rapidly. But now I didn't have to worry because I was in my my three-piece suit with a big blue corduroy necktie, and the idea that I was going to take any of this off for anybody was crazy. So you know, I was safe.
You probably just look like another freak to a lot of freaks.
Well, after about 2 weeks, one of the Ken Kesey's group, the Pranksters, named Doris DeLay, said to me, you know, you got on the weirdest outfit around here. And it was the most unusual in that particular little corner of the woods.
Would you ever let a journalist observe you, hang out with you? I don't mean just interview you and write a piece about you. Maybe this has happened already. But say a journalist wanted to almost move in with you for a few weeks, really get a sense of your life, follow you around on a story you were writing. Would you let anyone do that?
Probably not. I've never felt that anybody owes me the courtesy or favor of letting me observe them, or that nobody has any obligation to answer my questions. And by the same token, I don't feel I have the obligation to answer anybody else's if I don't want to. I don't think it's an inalienable right of the American press to be cooperated with. You know, most people, if they let the press observe them, are striking an implicit bargain. They feel that they know that there's something in it for the press, and they feel that there's something in it for themselves. And I think we might as well be frank about it. It is some kind of some kind of bargain. Not that the outcome is going to be, the outcome of what is written should be a certain thing, but that, okay, I'll give you this freedom of observation in hopes that I'm going to get this particular. I think that's the way it works out.
Well, that leads me to my final question, which is some people probably who got written about by you felt burned afterwards, thinking specifically of the Radical Chic piece that you wrote about a fundraising party for the Black Panthers at Leonard Bernstein's house.
Yes,
I'm sure he was sorry that you were there.
Yes, I think he was. I think you have to take, as the journalist, you have to take the position that what you are doing is important. That the process of discovery that you are going through. Is as important, if not more important, than any issue that is involved in the story that you're writing. In looking back at the story on Leonard Bernstein and the Black Panthers, the story Radical Chic, I think it was important to see exactly how the phenomenon that I called Radical Chic worked. What it was all about. And I think you can't afford to be constantly wringing your hands over the impact of what you're doing, whether you're talking about the impact on the individuals that you're writing about or the impact on the issues that are involved, in this case, support for radical groups in the late 1960s. I was heavily criticized after that for drying up fundraising, which I don't think I did, but drying up fundraising for these radical groups among wealthy people, among socialites in New York. Well, whether I did or I didn't, I don't think you can worry about that. I think if you start worrying about that, you're no longer writing. You're involved in public relations.
Tom Wolfe, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your ideas with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Wolfe, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. His latest novel is called I Am Charlotte Simmons.